You know, it's good to be good, but it's mostly, you know, it's great to be just doing things. You don't have to be that good. You just have to be able to produce stuff consistently. You know, a good animator hasn't missed an animation in years. Like, you know, the difference between a junior animator and like an intermediate animator is that there's barely any misses. Like every animation works. Maybe it's not the best, but it always works.
You're listening to the CG Spectrum Podcast. CG Spectrum College of Digital Art and Animation offers specialized career training for the film and game sector. Join our hosts, Career Development Manager Maxine Schnepp and CGS Mentor Justin Mullman, as they chat with industry experts doing cutting-edge work in film and games. Now, on to the show.
This week, I got to talk to Hubert Lapointe, who is a mentor of 2D animation at CG Spectrum. He started his career as a freelance illustrator, but then moved into being a software instructor at Toon Boom Animation, and he's also worked on TV shows like Rick and Morty. He's also a freelance animator, animation supervisor, and director, and now runs his own company, Bon Jam Animation, in Montreal, Canada. We talk about his journey, how he got to where he is now, but most importantly, we talk about how to value yourself as a freelancer and how to price and quote your time. A lot of students ask me about how to figure out their rates. If you're curious, check it out.
So I'm from the countryside. So I'm from Drummondville, which is like an hour away from Montreal. So I was not like in a urban area where, you know, animation or art in general would happen. So I basically moved to Montreal to study animation at a like Cégep level, which is like a college, you know, community college level in Quebec, the French side of Canada. And basically study animation there for a while, and then I got into the industry. And it was a weird time, like it was a different time than today, I guess, in the sense that like animation was not that popular, especially 2D, since 3D was starting. Video game was getting more popular. But yeah, from there, I worked in the industry for a couple of years as an animator. I did a couple other things in 2D, like rigging, compositing, like everything that relates to Toon Boom, because Toon Boom was starting to be a thing, you know, as a software in the animation before people were doing either Flash or I think paper was not that relevant even like 15 years ago, but, you know, still. Then from there, I moved on. I worked at, you know, Toon Boom, and I worked in a couple, you know, other studios when I got out of Toon Boom as supervisor, then director. And that's where then I started to work at CG Spectrum as a mentor as well, part-time.
When you first graduated college, what was that like for you? Like the difference between learning stuff at school and then actually having to get a job. I know you said that it was like a difficult time because 2D animation didn't seem as popular. When I was in school, I felt, and this must be funny to you too, like I wasn't even from a small city. I was from Toronto. But for some reason, when I was younger, I thought that, oh, if you want to work in movies, you got to go to Hollywood. Uh-huh. Like I just didn't know that things existed here. I mean, I do remember the time, and I agree. I think 3D animation was becoming more popular. Like I think at one point Disney movies stopped being 2D completely. Like they just weren't making them. Yeah. But how was that journey for you, and how did you even get your first job? Like what was that like for you?
Yeah, that was a weird time, but because basically like the school program was actually pretty good in terms of like technical knowledge. Like we've learned, you know, drawing and animating super well, but it was not super like software focused. So when you got into the industry, it was all about like, you know, how do I get that first job? Because there's a gap where you have to like just be able to use the software or the tools that the studio needs you to be able to use. And so that was a really tough time because basically I was not good enough in the software at first. So basically like there was like today, like often like there's a like animation test when you get into a studio, and basically I didn't pass my first animation test when getting into a studio. So what happened is that luckily they had like a rig job. So I started doing a bit of rigging so I could like spy on other people's scene while rigging stuff, you know, on my downtimes. And then I did, you know, another animation test. I got in and I started to work, but it was all about like trying to bridge the gap of knowledge that not only like school was not really teaching you, but it was because we were on a turn of technology at that point, right? Everything was changing. So it was hard for school to be able to teach you those things, because even the industry was just, you know, sort of like getting into that technical new venture, right? At first, it was like a tough experience, like because you're equipped, but you're equipped like artistically, but not necessarily technically. So then you have to work on bridging that gap And then, yeah, just trying to really understand what studios need from you, basically, to be functioning in their pipeline.
Do you think it's easier then and even now to kind of get a job in some of these side positions? Like, I think a lot of people want to be an animator, but there's so many other pieces to the puzzle of like how many people are involved and what roles are involved in like a TV show, an animated TV show. Do you think it's easier to get into some of those other roles like rigging?
Especially in 2D, I think so. Like in 3D, I think it's different because it's so technical. Like I think it's hard to just hit the ground running as a rigger in 3D and be functioning in a studio, right? But in 2D, especially if you're like in a smaller studio, like rigging might just be splitting a 2D character into layers and making sure that you're parenting the animated parts together, which is not that, you know, that complicated. And it shows you how the tool will be prepared for animation later on. So when you become an animator, if you want to become one afterwards, you kind of understand how to use the tools that are in the studio. But to answer your question, the thing is, most people don't know in 2D that there's other roles than animators. You know, often people will think that, oh, you know, 2D animation is basically mostly background artists and maybe storyboard, background artists, and then animators. And then obviously there's character designers and pre-production and all that. But in production, it's mostly backgrounds and characters because that's what you see on the screen. But you have like, again, all these sort of like technical prep that you can do. And the bigger the shows are getting these days, obviously the more technical people they need on the side. So like the last show I was directing, basically, I think at first we thought we could get along with like two or three tech artists. And then we ended up having like a whole team of like 7 to 8. And so obviously a lot of juniors went into those positions and were able to then transition to maybe compositing, rigging, animation, and then, you know, move into places of the pipeline that the felt more inclined to work in.
How do you suggest that people find out about some of these things? And like, what did you do to figure this out? Because you're like, well, I didn't pass my animation test, so I became a rigger. Like, what was that like? Like, I mean, first of all, what was it like to fail an animation test? Your first one.
I mean, I guess I was kind of used to in a way because I failed my animation test in school as well the first time because they were making it was a very intense course and it was a public course. So it was a lot of people were applying for it. So we were making a test to see if we were, you know, fit for the school. And so like I had to do like the test twice. So animation test twice as well. But I guess, you know, at this point I just wanted to work, you know, in animation. So like I pushed a little bit. I was like, yeah, you know, because they told me like, oh yeah, you're not passing the test. I'm like, ah, is there something else I can do, right? I was basically just trying to, because I mean, now I know, you know, now I think I know that when, you know, you're trying to work into a studio, like in a studio, most studios need you. Like they need people that want to work in on their pipeline. And so if you have a bit of skills and a bit of interest, they're clearly going to open a door for you at some point. Maybe not exactly when you're asking for it, but at some point there might be an opening. But so obviously I was pushing, but at the time, even though I was not that, you know, knowledgeable of that part of things, I was still pushing, trying to, I was like, I'm sure they're going to let me in at some point if I'm asking, you know, if I really want to help, I don't know why they would say no to that. Right. So, so I guess there's this part, like understanding that you're not, you know, it's all about helping a bigger team with other people that are trying to, you know, for example, when I was starting, I wanted to be a director at some point in my life. But when you start, you have to realize, oh, I'm just a small artist helping other people build this bigger project that's not mine. But then you realize there's so many tasks that can be done in that project. And sometimes you'll discover tasks along the way as well, right? And I think that's part of, as well, of the teamwork and being a team player, understanding that this is really like a team effort and see what you can bring to the team, basically.
Do you think that that's helped you become a better director in the end? Like, I think that's a good point. A lot of people kind of, they want this right away, you know, like being a director. Yeah. And it's not to say that you can never be one. And you're a perfect example of someone who's now been an animation director. How has that shaped your role as a director? Like having that experience from the ground up, do you think that there's other things that people value about you as a director because of your experience?
It's a weird journey to become, like, I think, an animation director because you, Like there's no one path to it, right? There's not like you're not getting a diploma and then boom, you're doing it. You might do it as a indie or art, more artsy like director, but if you're working in, you know, the industry has to vet you in so many ways because like it's like you have to be getting the trust of the production team and getting the trust as much as possible of the creative team, like the artistic team. And so I don't know, like for me, like I've always been really interested about like, you know, because I've always done freelance. So I was kind of producing like myself often. So I would have like a good knowledge of producing, but I would have as well a good knowledge of the pipeline. I know what a rig is. I know how to composite an image. I know how to animate most things that I ask people to animate on my shows. You know, they say sometimes like make before you manage. And I feel that my career has been sort of like anchored into that, right? Where I've done most of the things that I've asked people to do with me along the way. So there's probably other ways to do it. But for me personally, I think that was probably like, you know, very informative on how I would try to have empathy as well for people on the pipeline along the way. Because sometimes you ask people to do something and you're like, I can't believe we're, you know, making these guys do this right now because it's too much work or we should have thought about this before. So I've always been trying to think about the problems ahead of time, but that's because I went through them as an artist most of the time on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah. Or on your own projects, like solo, and you've had to do more than one task yourself. You know, you don't have a team of riggers or something to do it for you when you've had to do it on your own, I imagine. I'm curious, when you were in that stage of applying to studios and you said like, they got to let me in sometime, you know, was this just one particular studio that you were really, really interested in? Or was this like, you're trying to apply to like a bunch of them? Like, How was that process?
You know, at the time it was just one studio and not my preferred studio. It was the only studio open in Montreal at the time because the industry was, you know, in the downtime, like it picked up a little bit afterward, but there was like four or five semi-active studio at the time and one studio that was active most year round. And so I applied to them because I had a friend who got a job before me in the studio. So I was like, let me in too.
Yeah. If they can get it, I know I'm close.
Exactly. And that was a friend of mine who, you know, we studied together. And so, and it's funny enough because after that we worked together at Toon Boom. And so we went on and we did multiple projects together throughout the years. But yeah, like that first gig was really like, I was just really trying to get a job because actually the funny thing is I started with freelance, but it was, you know, at the time there was Angry Bird that came out and was super popular. People got into, everybody wanted to do like an iPhone game thinking they would get, you know, super rich, super quick. And so I had, a client that asked me to do a lot of visuals for a game that never got made basically. But for like 6 months, I had the chance to do like freelance. My first gig in animation basically was freelancing. And then I went into studios afterwards. And then I went back into freelancing afterwards, but, we actually like, now that I'm thinking about it, I started doing freelance and not.
Hey everyone, we're quickly interrupting this episode to tell you about a great resource, CG Spectrum's Career Pathways.
The entertainment industry is full of exciting opportunities to let your creativity run wild. Choose your field of interest from animation to 3D modeling, digital painting, game development, visual effects, and virtual production. And on our website, explore the different career paths available to you. Once you've set your sights on your dream job, we'll help you get there with our expert career training and mentorship from an industry pro. Learn more at cgspectrum.com/career-pathways. We're bringing the industry to you.
What's the difference between your initial freelance career versus your freelance career now? Like, what are some things that you wish you told yourself back then when you were starting? And like, how did you even get clients then as someone with zero experience? So it was like two questions, but I'm really curious.
it's tough, right? Because it's funny now because if you start in animation today, because of all the potentially remote works you might have with studios and still be an employee, for example, or if you work during the pandemic, I don't think that freelancing and working in-house is that different, right? Because to me, when I started, the big difference was working from home, working somewhere. That was mostly like the thing. And then, you know, now that I'm older and I have, a bit more of I'm a bit more financially secure, I don't, even when I freelance, most of the time I don't work from home because it helps me have a separation. So I rent a place where I go to work. What's the big difference? I guess now I just, it's a game basically. Like freelancing is a game that is, both your artistic thing that you're doing and understanding business a little bit to whatever level you want to learn it. Like when you start, it's just like, how do you price, your services? How do you find clients? These are still businesses knowledge that you have to have, right? Knowing like how to reach out to like people that might want to have your service and how to like tell them, how to explain to them how, how this works and what this costs and so on and so forth. But now, the big difference is now that I have more knowledge around freelance, basically like the freelance got bigger and now I started a studio. Like last year, I went from freelancing to like fully launching a small studio in Montreal. And basically it's not a big corporation thing. It's really just me getting to that new level where freelance can actually become a sort of a small business model if you wanted to, if you want to work with teams, for example, instead of just working on your own all the time. Because the cool thing is that, when you're freelancing, you can choose more the clients, the projects, the schedules you want to work on. And working as a small studio, you can work like that, but with teams. Teams that you choose, teams that you can create, they don't have to be big teams, but, I'll work with teams of like 3 to 4 to 5 people maximum, and we'll take on a project that we like. We'll build a schedule that makes sense for us, a budget that makes sense for us. We choose clients that we like, we work together. The big difference is like, it's really just you, and that's the thing when you start doing freelance, I feel like you're, at first you take everything or you almost take everything that comes your way. And then slowly you're like, oh, this wasn't fun. This wasn't fun. Or, there was a reason why this wasn't fun. It could be like related to how the type of budget, that was around that project. Maybe it was a client. Maybe it was just like the artistic side of the project or the timeline wasn't making sense for you. But after a while you start to like decide what you want to focus your energy on. Maybe that's the biggest thing about freelancing instead of being an employee is that sometimes you have a bit more flexibility around what you want to do, right? Because when you're working for someone, obviously you're kind of like giving away your talent in terms of like, if you give 40 hours, it's 40 hours that they decide to allocate to X and Y and Z project. Often you're going to decide which project it's going to be on. If you're working on a film, it should be on the film probably. But let's say you're going super fast, more fast than expected, on a project, they might put you on another project, another side project for like 5 hours a week because you're so fast on the other project. But if you're freelancing, it's different. You can take that 5 hours off, or you can decide yourself on the next project, right? So that's the, I think, even though like there's no, like, I'm not saying anything against being an employee, I think it's really great too. But it's just, I think that's the difference between like freelancing, then getting bigger as a freelance, and then understanding what differences there is between like freelance and like maybe being in-house somewhere.
Well, it also sounds like now you probably have a little more of the luxury and like hard earned luxury because of your experience of having the choice of projects, and people are maybe coming to you, or even if you're looking for a job, you know who to contact because you've built this network. Do you have any tips for people who are maybe starting and they're considering, to graduate school and go into freelancing right away for whatever reason, because of their lifestyle or where they live? Maybe there's no studios, not just one, but zero. What do you suggest for those people who want to freelance? How can they start?
Yeah, totally. But it's a great question because I actually have like some friends that right off school just went into freelancing right away. And most of them are still freelancing today. And everything, everything's going
amazing.
Okay for them. And I think that's the most important thing to think about, right? Some people will get stressed about going freelance instead of working somewhere. I guess that relates to your level of risk that you're able to take, or, level of uncertainty about, you know, what's coming tomorrow. Cause obviously when you're starting, you know, like you said, like it's getting those clients or getting those contacts in the industry will be harder. That's, you know, totally normal. Right. So the whole point is like, at first you have to be comfortable with being a little bit uncomfortable. And at some point you're going to get more and more comfortable in your situation. And you'll be able to maybe craft a bit more your reality. Back in the days, it was different in the sense that like, there was no Instagram. There was no, I don't think even LinkedIn was around, I think, when I started. And so,
yeah, it wasn't common, at least.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
for creative stuff, especially.
Exactly. Exactly. But nowadays it's like, everybody is consuming, you know, content, especially short content. And for example, animation or illustration or anything, visual videos, whatever, like everything is like short content. Like we're creators of short content that people might enjoy. And obviously most of our clients that we are looking for will probably want to have bigger formats of content than what we might share on social medias. But it's a good way to show them excerpts of what we can do for them, right? So obviously you can, for me, like obviously because I started as an employee, when I got, you know, sort of out, I obviously my first list of contact were people I knew from my days as an employee, right? But for example, let's say more often than not, people that go right out of school into freelance, it's because they don't want to work in the big machine, right? They don't want to work in the industry as more of a, you know, there's sometimes like a factory feeling to like an animation studio because there's so many, like it's so like intense, right? You have to work every day, like you do your small part and then, you know, the bigger project gets built, which is great, but some people feel better when they have control over a smaller thing. And so if you want to work, you know, if you want to go right away into like freelancing, for example, I think that instead of going to through the industry and then going out, you can go right away into just doing what you want to do, right? Doing illustrations or animations, or if it's 3D, you can do like, you know, sculpting of, if you want to do like, you know, modeling as a freelancer, then you do sculpting that you enjoy and you put it out there and you hope it's going to stick the, you know, with someone and that maybe somebody's going to call you, right? But the thing is like, social media is such a good tool. And I think that, I don't know for you, but I feel that sometimes artists don't use, for example, LinkedIn enough. Especially if you're trying to go a little bit more with the clients side of things, more with the, you know, industry-ish related jobs. Like LinkedIn, like posting on LinkedIn is like posting like good animation on LinkedIn, good illustration on LinkedIn, and you know, talking that you're looking for a job or talking about your process a little bit, like it will stick probably, especially because it's not an overcrowded market like Instagram can be, or I guess maybe ArtStation. You know, a lot of people do ArtStation, but not a lot of like animation supervisors are scrolling ArtStation to find the perfect gem, right? It's more a place where you put your stuff, but it's not a place where people actively look for your stuff necessarily.
You have to lead them to it somehow. Like usually people get to your ArtStation page because you gave them the link. Like, so it is possible to be found, I think, on ArtStation or Instagram, but yeah, like Instagram is really oversaturated. So, you know, it's good to put things out there, but sometimes I think it also depends, and let me know what you think of, how much you like social media, you know, because I have some students who are like, Maxine, like, I don't even have an Instagram account personally, you know, but I heard that I have to go on there because it's like, you got to use social media. And I'm like, honestly, like, if you're not already on there and you don't get it, or if you're not on TikTok already interested or following other animators, so you can see what they're doing and seeing this interesting content, it's going to be hard for you to get out there because you're not familiar with how the algorithm works, like in a basic sense, or what is popular, what makes a video popular on Instagram, what makes it popular on TikTok, how to actually get noticed versus just being one of those people that has 40 followers and they're just posting stuff every day, nobody's seeing it. You know, it's like 3 likes, 6 likes. And it's like, that's not helping anyone in that. Kind of seems to me like a waste of time if you're just putting stuff out there for like nobody to see. So do you have any tips for how to make content more interesting for social media? Like, do you still use social media for your own business or for yourself? And like, what's kind of the key? Like, what do you find is really gets consumed more when you post.
Like it's tough, right? Because I feel like we consume, like most people consume social media, right? So it's it's to me, there's a part where it's weird if we use it to sort of be like a passive mesh in that system, mm-hmm. and not necessarily like an active one, especially if you're a creator, if you want to show that you're creating and you can see that it's just an industry of people creating stuff. Like, I mean, if you take away like the corporations that have like full marketing, like departments to like post and so on. I think it's just, if you think about it, most accounts that you follow is just someone that decided to like render a video or, you know, create a JPEG out of one file, and then they put it out there, right? And that's what you do for work. Like that's most animators or most artists, you know, will do that at work. Why not post? Why not be a part of this? And if you're not, I guess it's thinking about why aren't you not doing it, right? So for example, for me, I'm not very active on social media, but since that I opened the studio, I realized that obviously part of the game for marketing is out there. So I'm using the material that we're creating at the studio to post on Instagram, and we'll probably post on LinkedIn as well. As you know, as an online educator, I started to post online some articles to share knowledge as well from you know my journey in the industry. But I think that when you know everyone can think about why they're either posting or not posting, and see if there's a valid reason that they might find that would be good for them to maybe engage with social media, right? So for example, like if you think it's, you know, showing off your things, think about the fact that if you're showing off your things out there, maybe a producer will find the help that he's looking for to make a project happen. It's not just for you. It's for other people that might connect with what you have to offer. If I have one take on social media is maybe to consume less and to be, you know, be an active part of it more. As a junior, it has never been easier to, you know, maybe like you said, like a lot of accounts are already rolling and it's pretty saturated, but it's still it has never been that easy to get discovered. If you were to do like videos of yourself painting, you know, on your Cintiq or tablet or whatever, and you put it on TikTok, you're probably going to have, you know, a bunch of followers really quickly that you wouldn't have never have had like at any other time in history before. So it's mm-hmm. kind of like for artists, it's pretty good because it democratized a little bit the process of being in the market, you know, because before there was like gatekeepers, people that would just, again, make you pass an animation test and would just say, it's not for
not
you.
Good enough.
Exactly. Yeah. If it was today and I would get, you know, not accepted in a studio because of a test, I could just turn away to social media and I could start to post. I could see that, oh, this studio didn't like my stuff, but some people like my stuff. Maybe it's 6 like, but maybe tomorrow it's 9, then it's 12. And then you realize, oh, some people might like that. And then, you know, I have a couple other like studio owners that I follow like online that I, you know, a lot of are talking about the fact that, you know, we see a lot of layoff in, you know, big corporations, you know, mm-hmm. in animation these days. And we all see that the size will shrink. Maybe you as a freelancer will be a lot more important in the market that's coming than before, because every industry will try to be leaner. They'll probably, you know, they'll probably hire more freelancers because they know freelancers don't need to be managed that much, right? Because they're used to manage themselves and so on and so forth. So there's a very positive side of being an active part of the community on the online, because, for example, for me, when I'm looking for help for a project with my studio, I'll look online and I'll look at people that, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, I need like a good character design. And I've seen like this guy that posts every day on LinkedIn that I like his stuff. And I'm like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, send him an email. I'll see if he's available. Right. And so just being part of the imaginations of other people can maybe lead up to something positive for you in the end.
Yeah. I think you made a good point. It's, you want to be conscious about your social media use, you know, like thinking about who's looking at this, who is my audience? How can I create something for the potential person who might look at it? Not just like, oh, I'm going to post it for fun. And yeah, not also not expecting an instant result. I think is important. You're not going to have some animation director find you like the day after you post and like, okay, I'm done, you know? But yeah, consistency is key. Like you mentioned something about, oh, like, you know, I'll find that person who's posting character designs every day. You know, I think even that is a subliminal, or maybe not subliminal, it's an obvious way to show someone in your position, like a director, look at how consistent I am. Look at my consistency. And like, I'm following through with something every day or every week. And so you can already just imagine, oh, they're going to be able to deliver new content for me on my show consistently, probably.
Exactly.
If they're doing this every day already, you know, it's almost like proving certain soft skills in like a practical way without just saying like, I work good independently on a CV, you know?
Yeah, totally. And one thing, if I can add, is that, you know, a lot of students will see, and a lot of friends that I've studied with, like, were more talented than me maybe, or, you know, I saw people that were just like, just overall super good, like art skills, super solid, but they never really apply these by being consistent, like, and producing consistently. Sometimes I'll see like a junior and I'm like, oh, he would be a good fit for this project. But if that person is not able to hit the ground running, it makes it really hard for the studio to deal with that person. And that's a big reason why some studios will hire freelancers at times, especially when they're in a rush, because they just want to have a quick, effective result now. And even for yourself, being able to produce daily or to a certain level that fits with the industry, it's just a good way to prepare yourself for the work that's coming. You know, it's good to be good, but it's mostly, you know, it's great to be just doing things. You don't have to be that good. You just have to be able to produce stuff consistently. You know, a good animator hasn't missed an animation in years, more often than not. Like, you know, the difference between a junior animator and like an intermediate animator is that there's barely any misses. Like every animation works. Maybe it's not the best, but it always works. Right. Yeah, and it's because they've done so much of it and they're not trying to like nitpick on themselves and not finish because they're not feeling so good about it. They're just producing stuff. Obviously the posting is like the next step where you have to accept that some other people will judge you on what you've done and maybe it's not perfect. And so I think that's why a lot of people don't post, because they're like, you know, I'm going to be judged by my peers on this drawing alone. Can I really post it? But I think you have to get that out of your mind, right? Because nobody's going to really judge you negatively. People will either be impressed or not most of the time. You know, nobody takes a time, like 5 minutes in their day to like think about how your drawing was not that good. You know, they'll either be like really be into it, or they'll be like, ah, yeah, whatever, next thing, right? We all scroll on it. We all scroll on the internet. We either stop or we don't. That's the only thing we do, right? So that's the thing too. Like, it's just being able to like sort of like get that bad feeling away from. I think that would help a lot of people probably post online.
Well, I think like you also made a good point of like we either like we're scrolling, we're all fucking scrolling, but like, you know, we either stop or we don't. So I imagine for someone trying to get out there, a good thing to kind of think about is what makes you stop, you know, when you're scrolling through like a bunch of like animation related things, what is making you stop? Is it a certain style? Is it something that's like satisfying? It's like, maybe it's beautiful. It's like something that loops really nicely. You know, I find a lot of the times with animation, if something loops well, you stop because there's none of that like start and end point. You just watch it over and over and you're like, oh my God, it's actually only 2 seconds, but it keeps looping like seamlessly. And that's like really pleasing to, I think, a lot of people, similar to like ASMR and like all those types of even like not animated videos of like people like spreading paint. It's like, what about that is so pleasing to us? How can I recreate that as an artist? I think is really interesting. It's not just like a fluke. Like it's not.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a very like subconscious thing, but people will feel that you're kind of like respecting their attention, I guess, like in a way, like, cause mm-hmm. it feels like it was crafted for being seen. And that's often something I try to tell to my, that's often something I try to tell to my students in class is like, cause when you craft your animation, you're so close to it and you've seen it so much, it's hard to know what will make it good for everyone. Right. Cause you're like, it works, but will it work for everybody? Like most people that will see it and being able to like, look, you know, you have to be able to pull back and be like, oh, that's for, I'll try to be for everyone with that piece as much as possible. Not everyone, but a good amount of people, let's say. And yeah, I think that when you see
or
those
animations. At least a hiring manager.
Yeah. But it depends, right? Because it's like, I mean, probably a hiring manager will be able to see the quality in something, for example, that doesn't loop. But the entertainment level of that piece won't be good enough for engagement on social media, for example, right? So it's the thing about like, can I create engagement with the audience, you know, and see that, and to think that animation, especially if you're an animator, but animation is really, or illustration, or you know, all these different crafts. It's you're doing it for somebody else as well, right? You're doing it, you know, as a it's like a meditation you're doing with yourself. But then when you put it out there, it becomes a relationship with the audience, and to make sure like, oh, is it interesting to watch? Is it, you know, adding value? You know, are people going to be entertained by this? And if so, you know, if I'm trying to make them laugh, is the timing good? Is it, you know, am I really playing on what will make that piece, you know, great? Cause I follow some of my students on social media after, you know, they're done with the class, and I can see that some of them get better and better, and they start to understand what sticks a bit more, right? And they start to like focus on like, oh, maybe, you know, people will like a short animation that makes them laugh a little bit, or that they think will be cute. And I think that it's really like to dive into that, like understand like, am I really, you know, hitting a mark? And the funny thing is that when you're going to try to get into a studio, it's the same thing, but it's just a bigger scale, right? You're trying to hit a mark with a client or an employer, but you still, the whole point is
certain
like
skill, like trying to showcase certain things. Yeah.
Cause you know, you can have like a demo reel, like all you want. Cause we all talk about like demo reel, but no, I'm not trying to hurt anyone, but some of the demo reels I had to watch as a, you know, animation director were painful to watch. Like it don't like, and it's okay. Like it just means that person's not ready for this task, but I'm not sure that person was thinking about whoever's going to watch this demo reel, right? To consider them for a position, because I would like to give a job to everyone. You know, when I was in the, you know, when I was in the studio and I was an animation director, when I was watching reels, we were in dire need of animators. I would have taken everybody that made sense for a production, right? But if I can clearly say you didn't even try to make it, you know, make it stick with me, like it's so hard to just say yes, right? It's like you have to, like that person would have to think about like who's going to watch that reel. And it's like that for everything. Every time you're doing something, you're like, mm-hmm. will the client be happy? Will the employer or, you know, whoever, will they be happy with what they see?
Yeah, based off like as much information as you can gather on whoever your audience is.
Yeah,
and
totally,
I think that's a good point too. It's like the demo reel, yes, it's so important for getting a studio job, but if you posted your full demo reel in its entirety on social media, nobody was going to want to watch that. Like,
no.
You know, maybe LinkedIn. Yeah. But even on LinkedIn, I think people would appreciate just snippets. Pick one of your animations from your demo reel and show just that one. And as people are scrolling, I think because LinkedIn has so much text and image-based posts, when you do see a video, it does kind of like make you stop, which I think is nice. But with Instagram or TikTok, it's like, if you post a whole demo reel with the titles and everything, like no one's going to want to watch that. It's not the right content for that space, but it could be perfect. Yeah, totally. It could be an amazing demo reel. And for someone else, for a studio and that audience and an animation director at a studio might be, wow, perfect. You know, or like thinking of like a rigging demo reel. That's so not interesting for social media to see the UI of like whatever you're working in and how you rig it and whatever. Like no one cares about the controls. They just want to see something cool, you know?
Exactly. But at the same time, like there was a lot of like rig demos that started to be popular in Toon Boom these days, because rigging is like still a thing that people don't master so well. And the software got a lot better in the last few years. So actually, I was amazed. Like, some people started to do rigs of popular characters that exist, you know, that clearly they don't own the IP for. But just to show off, hey, if I was to rig on that show, I could make it move really well, you know. And so I'm sure a lot of these people got jobs just based out of, like, again, knowing who they were talking to, like people that probably owns IP that want to make sure it's going to move well. And then, you know, obviously something that shouldn't be interesting will then become interesting to them. But I like what you said about, like, maybe having like a snippet of your reel, because imagine, you know,
depending as an animation, you know,
yeah. But imagine, like, as an animation director, I would receive only, you know, two clips. One is your best scene and the rest is the whole animation, you know, demo reel. That would be great. Because let me have a look at your best scene. If that's good, I want to see more. If that's not good, you know, thanks for respecting my time. Probably I would probably be more inclined to, like, write back to that person saying, hey, like, I saw your first shot. And then, you know, I was surprised you split that. You know, let's say, like, the one of the worst things or that can happen is, like, let's say I don't like your best shot. And then I see that you took the time to split it from the rest of the video would make me feel like I need to maybe engage with you. And say, hey, thanks for splitting your shot. Thanks for respecting my time. But maybe, you know, your shot is still not up to par with the project we're working on. Maybe if you were working on this, that would be, you know, a better fit next time. But I feel like I think I would enjoy seeing that person took a lot of time to just think about presenting it in a better way. And I would probably engage back in a better way as well, right? And sometimes it's hard because let's say I have like a demo reel of like 3 minutes, which is often, like, you know, juniors will send demo reels that are too long. I think like 1 minute, 1 minute and a half is good enough. Like, if you should be able to sell me on your skills by like the 1 minute mark. But sometimes people will send like a 3-4 minute demo reel. Often when we're hiring, it's like in a rush moment where you don't have, you know, you have less time than usual and you're watching it too many reels and you're like, I'd like to respond, but because it's so long, I'd like to give like an in-depth commentary on that demo reel, but it's too long. Like, it's too long. And if I just comment on one scene, they might answer me back with more questions and comments. And it's going to be like a back and forth that never ends. So again, like, thinking about, like, how can this be concise enough that people will want to engage with you as well? Right. So it's a whole process to find that right balance.
Well, and it's not easy. And I think this is what is so important, you know, for anyone listening. There is no one way, you know, and you really do have to think about, like, who is looking at this? What space am I in? Is it on social media? Is it here? Is it there? Where am I sending it? Is it relevant? I use this, like, analogy a lot, but you could be like the best animator in the world, but if, like, all you do is like horror and gore and like creepy stuff, like, maybe it's great for Adult Swim. And they're going to love it. You know, the next, like, Metalocalypse or whatever is going to be like, yes, you know.
Yeah.
But to someone doing, you know, here in Toronto, like Guru Studios that does like mostly children's animation, you could be so good. But they're like, well, we just don't do this here. You know, like, we make cute stuff and it's colorful and it's like friendly. And, you know, and you could have someone that's like just as good as you, maybe even a little bit worse, but they're making Paw Patrol type stuff. Like, that's our person. You know, when you are hiring juniors at your current studio or even in the past, what do you look for then? Like, what are some qualities outside of obviously like just good animation, but are there some other kind of qualities you look for or like things that you've noticed, maybe even examples in the past of people that were like, wow, that was a really good application?
It really depends on the pipeline, right? It's just because even like in 2D animation, it's going to be either like, let's say, cutout animation, meaning we're using puppets to animate, or it's going to be like traditional, meaning we're really, you know, end drawing every drawing of the animation. And these two pipelines will require like different type of people. And it's actually interesting because that's like that for everything. Like you said, like if you're, you know, doing, you know, the next Final Fantasy or you're doing Paw Patrol, like it's not going to be the same people working on both projects. And I think it's like that for everything. And even like, you know, the difference between TV animation and feature films or short films, you know, it's all these pipelines are very, very, very different in their DNA. And the more you're knowledgeable of these, the better, you know, you'll be to sort to find your fit on the on those projects, right? And personally, like for example, if I'm working, you know, in cutout animation, most of the time studios want animators to do their whole animation by themselves. So it's not like you don't really get any help for everyone. I think it's a little bit like that in 3D. Like I think you have a supervisor, but more often than not, like in 2D, like you're going to do your shot, you know, from A to Z with a bunch of approval, you know, stages. But in that sense, that means that as a junior, you need to be able to clear a shot for real. Like it has to, you have to be able to animate a shot in the style of the show. So for example, if you, you know, when I was working on Rick and Morty, like I had to like work to the level that they were asking me for. Like I would get retakes until it would be to the level that they wanted the show to be at. And when I was working on something easier, I would get less retakes. As an animation supervisor, that's what I'm looking for into like a junior. Can you make me give you less retakes? And I'm okay with giving retakes for sure. Like I think that's, you know, that's part of the job. But the whole point is like, if I give you retakes, and you do them, but it's still not working, and I give you another batch of retakes, and it's still not working, and I have to give you another batch of retakes, that doesn't really work, right? So in your demo reel, I have to see that, let's say I don't fully like what I see in the demo reel, but I'm like, oh, one pass a retake, and that could be on TV, right? If that's my thinking for example, cutout animation, that works. That's totally fine. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to be functional for example, TV animation. But if you're trying to work on a, you know, feature film, that's tough because now it's, you know, it's the quality that they're looking for is going to be, you know, higher. So you have to be able to push by yourself a little bit more. But for example, traditional animation, because it's a different pipeline, there's a lot of steps that juniors can do that don't require them to know the full pipeline. So for example, I had like a couple of projects this summer where past students of CG Spectrum worked as cleanup artists and coloring artists on traditional projects. So basically the animation would already be done pretty much, you know, very cleaned up, but the lines were still a little bit rough. So the idea was to come back on the shot and really retrace perfectly like every drawing and then paint bucket in those drawings, right? Which is not like the hardest part of the job, but it has to be done and it's time consuming. So if I see that, for example, you understand how to clean up with a line that makes sense professionally, then I know, oh, maybe they don't know how to animate to the level I want them to animate, but at least they know how to clean up an animation properly. And that's perfect, right? So sometimes if you're a junior, and I think that we often say like you should try to focus your portfolio on something that you are better at or you enjoy more doing. And so sometimes if you're not super strong yet in everything, maybe like try to skim a little bit through your material and make sure you focus on whatever might be useful for a pipeline, especially as a junior. And I think that's maybe one of the things that junior artists or, you know, sort of aspiring junior artists should be thinking about. Like what, you know, when I'm going to get into that studio, what is that studio going to make me do? Am I going to do a full shot? I'm going to do part of a shot. Is there a smaller task I can ask to be, you know, on to learn the gig before doing the whole thing? Like, is there like, Because when you don't know where you're jumping into, it's hard to do your sales pitch as well in interviews, right? Because you're like, I want to work in animation. But okay, but which part? What are you good at? What do you think we're doing here, right? that type of thing. Obviously, like you said earlier, like you have to have the knowledge, which is another journey, like to learn about all these things. But again, you know, I think that's, for example, at CG Spectrum, I think that's one of the, you know, cool things is that they're already in contact with mentors that work in the industry. So you can ask a bunch of questions. Like every class, I always say to the students, so you have like, you know, industry related question, right? So if there is, are there things that you're wondering about the industry that you don't have answers to yet? Because I could probably try to provide some beginning of answers at least to those questions.
Again, just kind of like imagining that you could give yourself advice when you were starting. How do you set your rate or how would you set? I think maybe now it's probably different for you because you have your own company. And so there's a lot of other factors like overhead. And you, like you said, you have a studio that you work out of. So like that's factored into the cost now. But yeah. If you were like working from home, you're just starting out, what tips would you give to people to figure out their rate? How do you figure out your rate? You have someone coming to you. Oh my God, they actually want me to work on something, a job. And then they ask that question, what's your rate?
It's a tough question because I think there's not like one way to sort of, you know, come up with a number that makes sense. Obviously, you know, it has to be sort of like taking in consideration like where you're living and where are your client base. The first thing is you have to keep in mind that it should be more than if you were doing the same job in a studio. Studios will always pay a part of your income tax in the way they're dealing with fiscal issues. So basically, you're going to pay more tax when you're going to, you know, close your year, basically, if you're just working as a freelancer. So you have to charge a bit more right away. Like it's worth more for sure. So if you obviously then comes the question, how can I know how much this is worth in the studio? Like sometimes that's hard, but it's worth asking people that do this position in a studio, at least like at first, because there's going to be dozens and dozens of them on the internet, maybe even in your circles, like, you know, maybe some past students from the school, for example, or, you know, when I was in school, when we got out of school, everybody was sharing their salary when we had our first job. So you could see which studio was paying better. And you could sort of like map out like, okay, what is a junior position worth for, you know, this city? Well, let's say I'm animating on a show. They probably already have a sort of a, you know, price they want to pay for that task, right? And they won't really budge that much from that budget. And that's different than having like, for example, ad agency client that wants you to do a one-off, right? Because then that's different because they have a budget for that project. It's a smaller project. Maybe they were expecting to have a whole team. Maybe you're just, you know, you on this project, or maybe you'll have like a small team, but not as big as what they thought at first. And so maybe you can think about like, okay, it's not just a task anymore. It's like a project. I'm doing something. So for example, if you were building a house, you would charge for all the materials, you would charge for everything. So it's a different way to price, you know, the thing if you're doing a whole project for someone. But if you're just doing a part, it's good to know what that part is worth. Think about not only the task that you're doing, because that's one thing, but you're often providing your own material, maybe your own licenses. Maybe, you know, there's a bunch of things you should be providing yourself. You know, you probably have a place you're working from. Usually like a studio would pay for utilities when you're there, but you know, now it's you. And so thinking about like asking, trying to price that, right? Try to price how that much, you know, how is your software, you know, costing you per month? How is your material costing you per month? If it's a computer, for example, let's say, decide on an amount a year you want to put the value of your computer on, right? For example, you're going to use that computer 5 years to do freelancing, then split it on 5 years. So every year I have to repay this computer, I don't know, like a, let's go the high ticket item. Let's say it's a 5,000 computer, then that means that you have a $1,000 every year you have to repay on that machine. And let's say you work, we'll give a fictitious number, but like 200 days out of the year. So you have $5 a day that you have to repay your machine, right? So it's just a thing like, okay, $5 a day. So it's not, if I'm working 8 hours, it's not an hour a day. It's like 60 or 70 cents, whatever. But you have to factor that in, right? Because every hour you don't get this, then you're losing your machine. Like you're not paying for it. And the thing is, if your machine is already paid for, great. But in 5 years, you'll have another machine to pay for. Obviously, when you're starting out, sometimes it's really hard to plan properly for the future. But the best thing is to have, for example, a separate bank account in which you put money for the future, not for retirement or something personal, for you as a working artist. You know, you put money in there and you make sure that you're going to have computer, software. If you're able to like price a client a bit more, you know, good. Often what I would do would split the money. Like let's say I would try to save money for me personally. If there's an extra that a client pays me because it's a contract that I'm able to ask for more, I'm able to finish early or whatever, I try to do 50-50, 50 for the, you know, for the saving account, but 50 for the professional account that might need some money, right? And at some point, once you get a bit of money in that account, the cool thing is that you can maybe at some point hire a friend to help you on a project and you don't have to wait for the client to pay you to pay your friend. Like, especially if you know it's a client that's going to take months and months to, you know, pay the full project. But all in all, to say that the whole point is to plan a bit, you know, and think about like, I'm talking about hours, you know, I was saying like, you know, 50 cents an hour for your computer, but maybe at some point you won't want to plan hourly base. Hourly base is a North American employee-employer type of relationship. Maybe you want a price per day. I had a friend who, you know, when he started as a freelancer, he said to me at some point, I'm never spending less than a day on a project. And I'm never spending less than 10 hours a day on a project. Like, I try, and obviously he was looking for types of project that would require a day of work, but he was saying, if I'm not working actively 10 hours, I'm thinking actively about this project before starting out, right? Mm-hmm. Or I'm first. So now hours don't make sense. It's really like a day thing. And then you can start to charge per day if you prefer that way to do things. Obviously, if you're doing super small tasks, it's really hard to say to someone like, hey, I'm going to take a day to do this. But if you're doing, for example, illustration, some people will try to cheap you out of illustration work by saying, oh, how much time did you spend on this illustration? Like 4 or 5 hours? And you're like, I thought about the sketch for this for like 3 days and then I took a day to do it.
Yeah.
But obviously, maybe as an artist, you'll charge 2 days or maybe 3 days. Or Exactly. And so it's the thing about that, right? Because obviously, if you work for a studio, they were probably prepared to work for you. You know, so you won't have much thinking to do, like, you know, often like stuff that, you know, most animator might discover with their first gig. But as an animator, you don't decide anything. You just execute on a storyboard that is already provided to you. But as a freelancer, maybe sometimes they're going to ask you to come up with a storyboard suggestion. And then maybe you're going to do it quick, but you will think about it like 5 hours before to really find the idea. And so at some point, the question is, do you bill for that? Do you not bill for that? I would highly recommend everybody to bill for the time you work on things. Because sometimes at first you think that thinking is not working. But that's not true. Like if you go to school and you learn how to think about, for example, storyboarding, then that means that the whole time you're thinking about it, that's prep time, right, for the work. And obviously, I'm not saying like, you know, go play video games and think about it. I'm more thinking about like if you were sketching very loosely and nothing concrete comes out of it, it's still working time, still prep time that you can factor in. One last thing as well about like, you know, just pricing was that – let's say you go all the way. You're like, okay, like I have a big computer. I'm paying licenses and so on and so forth. And when you add it up, the number is pretty big. And it's big. And you realize, oh, it's big. I'm not sure the client will pay for that. Right? And that might happen and it's okay. But I think it's if you ever discount your price, you have to know it still. What is the price? Yeah. Right? Because if you're discounting the price, if you live your whole life at discount, you're going to be probably in big trouble financially at some point, right? So it's okay to start out at discount, but it's like you have to ramp up at some point to the price that you set for yourself in the beginning. And then maybe you're going to scale up from there. But the idea is that even when you start low, because sometimes like, you know, when you're starting, like you say, you don't have any clients. First client you talk to, he only has like $200 to do like a full week of work. And you're like, oh, like that's nothing, right? I can't even like,
yeah, I'll pay, yeah, like, I can't live, you know, off
a rent, a bit of food with that. Exactly. And it's okay, but it might be okay, especially if the project will go well in your portfolio, right? I'm not encouraging everybody to work for visibility. That's not the point, but you might make a conscious professional decision that this is a good move. But if you do it, you have to always say, oh, this was at a discount and I could let my client know my price is this. Mm-hmm. This is a discount. I'll do it for you once, but after this, it has to be closer to my number. You have to know how long things take you, because then it will be easier to tell your client how long this will take you. And if you're not working freelance, let's say you are working for someone, let's hope it's someone great and they're, you know, they know how to schedule your work properly. But let's say you work with somebody that didn't plan properly. As a junior, you'll just feel crazy most of the time. You're like, well, why is this going so fast? Why am I not able to finish in time? If you're used to tracking your time and knowing, for example, how much it takes you to do like 10 seconds of animation, maybe you're going to realize, oh, they didn't plan properly and we don't have enough time to do the work. And maybe, you know, even if you bring it up to them, they won't really like the information. They won't really engage with you. But at least you will know you're not crazy and you will know that, okay, this is maybe not the best studio for me because they're not planning properly. This client wants me to do a lot of stuff, but it doesn't make sense, you know, temporarily as well. You know, it's not just budget, but it's, you know, the time factor as well. So knowing how long things take you when you're an artist and you're doing stuff and how much money. You know, you need to live off of your craft. These are two really important factors. And as a freelancer, these are like the two big metrics you can control, because you can become faster as well, or sell a service that goes faster. You know, a lot of people will see illustrators, for example, that have a very slick graphic style that probably doesn't take them as much time as some other artists. And it's not better or worse. It's just a style that takes a day instead of five to do one piece. Right. And so then you can control that factor of, oh, every piece takes me less time, so I can do more piece and, you know, hopefully make, for example, a better living out of those. Right. So it's just be mindful of that.
Often when someone asks you for the rate, it's not always this like, that's it. You know, you give them a number and that's it. It's usually a conversation. Usually it's a negotiation. Mm-hmm. Like you can say, well, my hourly rate or my day rate is X, let's say like $100, right? Just to make it easy. But it depends on the scope of work on a project. Because, you know, my rate could be $100. And if they're like, wow, $100, that's great. I think it's only going to take a day, you know, here's your $100. But what if it takes a month? Can they afford $100 a day for a month? You know? And so I think oftentimes it's, you have to educate yourself on how long things take you, but also in some cases you have to educate or inform the client or even at a studio to let them know, hey, this isn't possible in this time, or this is approximately how long this will take me. And maybe oftentimes when I talk to students, what I'm hearing, oftentimes there's also the need to have another conversation with this potential employer or client about what even the scope of work is. Because sometimes people reach out to them being like, oh, I really like your demo reel or your art station. What's your rate? And you're like, well, what for? You know what I mean? Like, you can give them a number, but it's going to be kind of useless if you don't know how long you're working for them or what you're actually making. So what I tell students, and let me know if you like this, because if so, I'll keep telling them, is, you know, to start the conversation like, okay, here is my rate. And based on what I know about this project, it's going to take me X number of days. So it's going to cost you, let's say, approximately like $1,000 at this day rate. I think it's going to take this long. But if you're paying me per day, it could take longer. If you give me more notes, it could take longer. Let me know if that's within your range. Is $1,000 good? They might say, oh, no, I only have 200. You know, so then it's like, okay, I have to decide whether 200 is still worth it for me. Or you say, well, why don't we work within your budget, you know? Give me a base rate, and then any revisions on top of that get charged by my day rate. So I'll do what you need me to do for the 200, but that's not going to include 10 rounds of revisions for the rest of my life. Like it's going to be like, here's what you wanted for this discount. But if you want more on top of that, if you change it or add an extra 10 seconds of animation or whatever, then we go into day rate mode.
Sometimes juniors will come in and they will be kind of like doubting. I feel like that you know, it's good that you know about rates and so on and so forth, but be part of the conversation as well, right? Ask questions. Most people don't try to scam you. Like it's, and if they don't have the answer, it's probably because they want to give you a good answer, but they don't know yet. And they're humble enough to take the time to understand what they don't know. And so it's often like what might feel like a confused situation when you're a junior might just be, you know, like you said, a conversation that needs to happen before getting some feedback, right? It happens at every level all the time. Like even when we work between studios, obviously, this is super complicated, so we have to have a lot of conversations before saying yes. But it's the same thing with a new artist, right? Because a new artist has to fit in that system, especially if they're freelance, because they won't be in-house. So you have to, you know, make sure they will work well within the pipeline. But as artists, you know, be patient as well. You know, especially if you're trying to have a win-win situation in a way, because when, you know, if you're trying to pull a little bit on the sheet and have a bit more of, you know, your favorite position happening, which is totally fine. I think that's what you know, bargaining is for. Understand that it will take time. It's not just like you said, you know, if you say a rate and they don't like it, it's not a yes or a no. It's more of a, we'll come back to you. And we'll come back to you. We'll probably be like, oh, can we afford this rate? Can we go halfway? And, you know, it's always being open to, again, I think, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, posting and thinking about how it will, you know, maybe reach people and what it can give to people, whether it's entertainment or maybe like, you know, value or whatever. But I think it's the same thing when you're working with a potential client or studio. It's like, okay, it's too much for them, but I don't really want to budge from my rate. But maybe they don't understand that I'm adding value that they don't know about. So maybe you can push a conversation in that direction. Or maybe you realize, oh, okay, that's not the price you're paying for that role in your company. Obviously, I want to be paid a little bit more than in the company because, you know, like we said, you need to budget more stuff than just being an employee. But you understand now that their in-house rate is much lower than you thought. So now it's, if you want to work with this company, you have to respect the fact that their budget is built around a certain rate, right? So obviously you can ask for more, but you have to respect that, you know, it cannot be like triple what they pay someone doing the same thing in-house. That doesn't make sense, right? So again, it comes down to what we were saying earlier, but knowledge, like understanding who's talking in that conversation, what are the parameters of that discussion. And sometimes as a junior, you don't know anything. Like, and I mean, you come to really fresh to a discussion and you discover everything as you go. But I guess the main thing is to be curious, basically. Right. Because the more curious you're going to be, the more open you're going to be to like your potential clients or collaborators, the more you'll understand like, okay, these guys work that way. These guys work that way. And slowly you can understand that most people kind of work that, you know, in those ways. And then you can try to work with these people.
You mentioned that we are in this sort of informational age. You know, there's so much information out there. I think more people are turning to tutorials, online schools. I mean, even now, compared to what YouTube was when I was in college, I think back then it was just like funny videos. And now it's like you can find tutorials or troubleshooting for like almost anything out there. Whatever software you're using, someone else has already used it probably, and they're trying to help you. So in that sense, I think there's more people turning to online learning in some form, whether it's like self-directed or at an online school or even regular colleges. I think half their classes are online now. What are some tips you have for people who are e-learning, like anyone in that space? How can you succeed in e-learning? What are your tips?
So I wrote an article on LinkedIn a couple of weeks back, and I'm in the process of writing many more coming soon. But and the first one was relating to e-learning, and I think that the main two things when you're thinking about doing e-learning and planning well for it is to think about like time management and attention management and commitment of both of these things. When you commit to studying, you have to think like, okay, how much time do I want to spend studying that thing? Because, you know, we were talking about scrolling earlier, but you can consume YouTube videos on a subject for hours and hours and hours and hours. And that can be good if you're going for the full knowledge persona at the end of the day, like knowing everything about a subject. But if your goal is practical use of that, you know, practical use of that subject, you have to find a way to apply this, right? So you have to like structure. There might be a theory part. There might be like a practical part where you have to apply that knowledge, either, you know, if it's writing or modeling or you know, animating or whatever. But you have to, you know, do this. But the thing is, I think you have to plan for it like every week. Every week you have to think like, okay, let's say I'm starting this week. How much, you know, how many hours do I want to spend on that week for learning, right? So it can be 5 hours, 10 hours, 1 hour, whatever. This has to be like a part-time job, you know, in a certain way. And I think that, you know, it's easier for especially young students when they're going into a campus because everybody's doing the same thing, right? You're turning around. Some people are playing video games, but I mean, like most people are studying, right? So the whole thing is like you're committed as a group to study, and you know there's like a peer pressure to do it, right? If you want to do your thing, you have to do it yourself because, you know, most like often you're not going to have peer pressure for the exact thing that you want, right? You're going to have like partial peer pressure, but you have to think about being your own peer pressure on doing stuff. And so planning for yourself, like, okay, I'm committing, like, for example, 10 hours per week for, let's say, at CGS, we're on 12-week rotation terms. So let's say you're committing to like a thing like CGS, like, okay, I want to work on this thing, animation, for example, 2D animation for 12 weeks. I want to work 5, 10, 20 hours a week, whatever. But it has to be planned. Once that is planned, you have to put it in the calendar and you have to commit to it. And it has to be like a campus in your head, right? You have to like really go to it and be like, okay, it's in my calendar. I have to do it. And once you're done, you have to sort of like have a checklist, or you have to find a way to check it, right? So make it, oh, I did my Monday study. And if you haven't done it, why, right? So why? And if you haven't done it, then you have to reschedule as much as possible in the same week, that block that you didn't do somewhere, right? To make sure that globally the week will still get that 10-hour, study that you said you'd be doing. And so I think that the whole, it's like everything, right? It's just because it's especially animation, but most things in animation will be practice, practice, practice. You have to do it over and over and over again. And the first week of 10-hour, it's not going to show. And the 12th, week of effort, it won't show. But in 2 years, in 3 years, in 4 years, that's going to show by a lot, right? You're going to be like off the charts. You're going to be like one of the best, in a studio, but you have to commit every week to that, right? And it can be learning at first, and it can be practice. You can always scale that up, and it can be freelancing, right? Because you can then say, oh, I'm freelancing 30 hours a week or 40 hours a week or 20 hours a week. You don't have to, yeah, when you're freelancing, the magic... Yeah. But the magic thing when you're freelancing is that you don't have to work 40 hours a week. You can, if you want, you can do more than 40 hours a week, but nobody says that you have to work 40 hours a week. That's corporative, mindset. That's, totally functional for group effort, but as a personal effort, you decide. You're your own boss and your own journey. So you decide, because obviously at first, for example, like you won't have 30 hours worth of freelancing, right? But maybe you want to commit to like 15 hours of research of clients and then 15 hours of portfolio building. And at some point you'll replace the portfolio building by doing the work that your clients bring you. And then maybe you have too many clients, so you stop reaching for more clients and you do 30 hours of work a week, right? So you kind of work with that, but you commit at the beginning of the week to like 30 hours of working on me being somebody in that industry.
I love that. Well, with that, let's end. I mean, I could talk forever, but it was really such a pleasure chatting with you today. There's so many good tips in here. Oh my God, it's jam-packed. Let us know, where can we find you?
Thanks again for having me. If people want to find me, they can find me on LinkedIn as Hubert Lapointe. I'll have obviously a bunch of articles coming up. And if not, they can find the studio on LinkedIn. So Bone Jam Animation, BONJAM Animation, both on LinkedIn. We have a website, bonejam.ca. We're a Canadian studio, and we have bonejam.ca on Instagram as well, where we'll be posting a lot of our work.
And you can also learn from Hubert at CG Spectrum if you're interested in learning from him, because you sound like a pretty good teacher.
I try.
Thanks again. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I'll see you around.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for listening to the CG Spectrum podcast. For more on this episode, visit us at cgspectrum.com/podcast. Check out our show notes, where you'll find links to our guests and more behind the scenes. And if you're enjoying the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you're listening, or share this episode with someone who might like it. See you next time.